Robert Badgerow is the first person in Canada to be tried four times for the same first-degree murder. The Hamilton Spectator has told the story from the very beginning. I'm David Crosby, and this is part five of Covering Diane, a Spectator serial podcast about nearly four decades of our coverage of one murder. The murder of Diane Rowenduits and the prosecution of Robert Badgerow together form one of the most enduring crime stories in Hamilton history. The Spec has published nearly 250 articles on the homicide and its trials since 1981, with no end in sight. What is it about the murder of this young nursing assistant that has captured and held the public's attention for all these years? The Spec's crime columnist, Susan Claremont, has covered Diane longer than anyone.
Of all the cases I've covered in 25 years, and there's been quite a few, this is the one I find most intriguing for a whole bunch of reasons. Because legally, it's fascinating. Robert Badgerow is the first person in Canada to be tried four times for the same first-degree murder. And that in itself puts this into a different category for me, a different sphere. It's been a legal quagmire for almost 40 years. And that in itself makes it very, very interesting for me. But there's also the forensics of this. The forensic technology that was available in 1981 is so vastly different from where we are now. You know, the fact that so much about this case revolves around DNA, the DNA that was found inside Diane Rowenduits, and the fact that it matches Robert Badgerow, nobody knew that in 1981. No one could have known that in 1981 just because for the very fact that DNA science hadn't advanced to that point, and DNA science wasn't used in courtrooms in 1981 the way it is now. It's also a look at a time and place in our history as a community that I find very interesting. But this is a snapshot of what our community was like then. The prevalence of the steel mills. Not only did Robert Badgerow work at DeFasco, but the alternate suspect, Brian Miller, worked at the other steel plant. He worked at Stelco. You know, and we hear from witness after witness who worked with Badgerow at DeFasco, and we learn about the culture there. You know, the guys who worked in the steel plant, and they were virtually all men, and it was a real boys' club. We learn about the processing of steel and the hard, dirty, physically demanding job that Robert Badgerow did. That points to the fact that he was a strong, fit man. There's, you know, there's Stony Creek and the role it plays in this case. There's a particular apartment complex in Stony Creek that becomes almost a character in the story as well.
These are, we're at numbers 50, 60, and 70. Jerome Crescent are the addresses of these three massive apartment buildings. And Diane Rowenduits lived in the middle one.
Okay. So this is 60.
In the 60, yeah.
You know, it's not lost on me that it also is a bit of a commentary on society, the role of women, the role of sex and meeting people at bars and, you know, how all that fits into this story as well. I mean, all of those things still exist, but I think our attitudes about it have changed a little. You know, the idea that some people have that you had to be a certain kind of woman to have sex with a man that you've just met at a bar, how attitudes about that, you know, vary from 1981 to now. I mean, I think that plays a role in it as well. Maybe even more so how our attitudes about sexual assault have changed. You know, Diane Berendowitz was, the court has decided, was raped. And, you know, there's a powerful moment right after the verdict at the fourth trial. Robert Badgero has been found guilty and is taken away to prison. And the sister-in-law of Diane Berendowitz is there in the courtroom, Carl Berendowitz's mother. And she says to me, in the moments after that verdict, she says, you know, let that be a reminder to all women who are victims of sexual assault that sometimes you will be listened to and you will be believed, which was very powerful because in this case, of course, you know, the victim of the sexual assault can't speak for herself, and all these years have gone by without justice. So, you know, these are all things that intrigued me about this case. And then on top of all of that, you layer all these personalities, all these characters that have emerged throughout this case.
Former city editor Carla Amaretta puts it this way.
It reads almost through thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of transcripts like a thriller, but there's so many elements to it. There's the tragedy, there's the legal drama, there's just so much interest around it. And I also think that Hamilton is the smallest big city that I've ever experienced. The story of Diane Berendowitz really just resonates with people. Here you had a 23-year-old who was making her way in the world, who was a nursing assistant and had her sights set on bigger things, who was about to enter what should have been the prime of her life, and who was senselessly murdered at a time, you have to remember, that there was great fear because there were a series of other rapes and attacks and assaults on women that were going on at the same time. So I think really Diane represented really the worst outcome and the worst fear of any young woman and any parent, certainly, in Hamilton. And I think the community held her memory dear. And then once you had a breakthrough in the case, remember that there were many years that went by before a suspect was even identified. I think each time it was brought to the fore, there was a sense that there might be a conclusion to this and that there might be justice for Diane. But yet again, there were always these twists and turns throughout the many cases. You had such elements as DNA evidence, which seemingly cracked the case. But then there was testimony about, you know, there was a casual sexual encounter that Badgero admits to, but he says quite clearly that when the woman left, she was fine and she was heading home. You had an alternate suspect theory, which was brought forward in one of the trials, and at the same time that all of these attacks were going on, that you had a convicted serial rapist living amid the community where Diane herself lived. And I think with each successive trial, Hamiltonians have a very long memory and they hold things very dear to their own hearts that are their own. And that has been what the Berendowitz case has become about. And really, it is, they have not seen the finality in this even yet. And also remember that Robert Badgero has lived among the community for many, 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 many years. He is a friend and a neighbor to those around him in Binbrook. He has seemingly lived the life of a model citizen in the intervening times in which he hasn't been incarcerated over the various legal proceedings. So he is still very much in the community as well. So I think both of the names have become a touchstone and a frame of reference for a community and for the newspaper as well. And the story has also produced quite a few things that the Spectator should be proud of in the form of long-form journalism. We've had the opportunity to tell the story in a book form because that is exactly what this is. It is a book, but we're just still waiting to write the ending.
Retired court reporter Barbara Brown says readers were intensely interested in the paper's coverage of the case.
The Spectator has owned this case. We have been on this story since the day when those children playing in the ravine discovered Diane's body with the purse strap wrapped around her neck, face down in the creek. And, you know, the way that her body was found was so distressing and public, and it's always been a public case. And because it was a cold case and an unsolved case, it had always been talked about in Glanbrook and Stony Creek, and indeed in Hamilton proper as well. And so I think it was always a high-profile case. And so when the Ravine Task Force came out and that hotline was set up to see if anyone could identify the voice on the 911 call, it was very much in the minds of the public.
The Spec has made a commitment to the case over nearly 40 years because it recognizes that the story resonates deeply with the community, says managing editor Jim Poling.
This is one of those stories that you can see it. You see the players, you see the neighborhood, you see the faces, and you hear from people who went to school with Robert Badgell. And I think it's part of what it's being in a community, in a paper like ours, you see the effect of how it plays out.
It's true, right? I mean, we meet people all the time, readers, our neighbors, you know, people we know in the community. And I think people feel a real connection to this case. And the connection is real. It's like, I know somebody who knows Badgerow, or I worked with Badgerow, or I knew Diane's family. Like, there are real connections to this day with this case.
Oh, absolutely. You see the bar, the parking lot where it started, it's not there now. The mall is there. The creek is there. People can still walk by it. Diane's apartment is still there. My brother-in-law lived in that apartment complex. So it becomes very, very real. Just on a newspaper being connected to the community, telling the stories of the city, this story is with us and is very real in that sense. And then you layer upon all the other legal pieces around it. When you look at, we're going into our, 37th year, four trials, two convictions, two appeals, an unprecedented fourth trial. It's no wonder we spent a long time talking about this.
Poling, like Amaretta, says the story has all the elements of a thriller.
It takes place in the outskirts of booming Hamilton. 17 years later, you have this arrest, and it's tied to, you know, our steel mills and parts of a deal with rural Hamilton. It's just tied to the whole fabric of our city. It has so many elements, large and small, and the stakes are massive. And think about that whole arc. You know, we had, over the years, we've done stories of police work done, police work undone, not very good police work, some dogged police work. And then technology comes into play. And it's really the evolution of modern science or forensics, and you get DNA evidence, which really flips us. So it's this story that sepia tone that comes through black and white is now into color and then high definition. It's fascinating on so many levels.
I've also been intrigued by all of the characters involved in this case. I mean, you know, we've just talked about Diane, and you know how she's just a young woman trying to walk home safely one night. But there are so many other interesting people in this story. I mean, of course, Badreau. But then there are these characters like Cheryl Zick, the Crown attorney, who, you know, I see as a true hero in this whole story. Cheryl started on this case when she was still a law student and has seen it through and has been, you know, in the legal system, the voice for Diane all the way along.
Talk about an advocate. But, you know, that's the other part that makes the story real and makes the investment easy, frankly, is the dogged storytelling and journalism. It's looking at Diane's story, at Robert Badreau's story, at Cheryl's story, the story of a phone booth. A phone booth by a steel mill becomes a central character.
That is one of the neat things about our history with this story, is that really, from a journalism perspective, we've left no stone unturned. I mean, there isn't anybody, including Robert Badreau himself, involved with this case that we haven't reported on and probably interviewed at one point in time. Between Barb and myself, I mean, we have interviewed every lawyer, many of the jurors, most of the witnesses, all of the key players, the cops, everybody.
But at its highest level, covering Diane is about much more than a good story, as Pauline and Claremont know.
I think it's human, I think it's right, and it's a search for justice. And it's either, you know, through all the search for Diane's killer, or the search to find out whether Robert Badreau was guilty or innocent. Diane's story is just so touching and haunting. And I think that's part of it. I know you have this deep connection and are one of the few people who are there to tell her story. And that part just makes me, it's just so sad. You know, here after all these years, there's few people that are actually speaking for Diane. A columnist at the Hamilton Spectator, a reporter who's doing her job in giving, you know, voice to somebody who can, and the Crown attorney. And it's just on that level alone is fascinating. And I don't want to say it's a good story. It's just a story that has to be told. And I just think it's the role of a paper of our size and our commitment to the community to stick with. But, you know, the other part of it, Susan, it's interesting. For as many hours we put into it, it's really two reporters that have dominated, which is interesting. You know, Barb Brown, who started and finished her career with Badreau, and then you picked it up and are still writing about it. And that's remarkable in a journalism setting.
You and I have talked many times. I mean, for me, it is all about Diane and about justice for her. This woman who is now being dead longer than she was ever alive. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things resonate with me in a big way. And, you know, I'm proud of our coverage because we have always put Diane first. It's easy, always easier to put the salacious details and the accused first, but we've always kept Diane in the spotlight.
Cut. Covering Diane is a serial podcast produced by David Crosby and Susan Claremont at the Hamilton Spectator.